interview with an MVP.
What more do we need to say?
Why are we here? And who are you? And why are you on my show?
I'm Alan Rafies, and if I'm not mistaken, you're Dave Kula.
That's what my name badge tells me, yes.
Excellent.
Yep. So we are here today to talk about some very cool things. Clinton, Crystal, why don't you tell us about those very cool things that we're going to talk about?
That's a great question, Dave. You know, Crystal, so what are we here to talk about?
Quas.
Is that Santa Quas?
Santa Quas.
Quality of service.
As part of our Hyper-V operational training series that we've been going through here on Channel 9 with you folks. And the last piece that we're going to be sharing with you in this session is a lot of the different features and functions of Hyper-V that don't necessarily fit into a specific bucket, if you will, right? So, you know, dynamic memory being one of those.
That you love.
Dynamic memory I love.
Good for every prod workload.
Every single, especially, you know, SQL Server. The most mission-critical applications, you should definitely look at dynamic memory. Said no Hyper-V admin ever. And then
but
also,
it is a supported technology.
Just because it's supported
just
doesn't
because
mean
you can
you
doesn't
should.
Mean you should.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
it's
for
kind sure. of like upgrading servers, Alan. Just because you can pop the CD or DVD in and go next finish and upgrade your servers, it's not necessarily a good idea
That's
to
a good
do
point.
That.
So these are some topics that'll be talked about.
Yes, absolutely. So we're going to talk a little bit about storage quality of service. That is a really important one, actually, because as your environment grows and expands, you need to be able to keep a handle on that. And one of the big things is that we're starting to get a lot more horsepower in our data center, especially from our storage, because people are moving to all flash or, you know, hybrid flash type solutions where, you know, they're not as constrained as much from a storage IO perspective. And having the ability to take and throttle that and kind of choke that down, especially if you're in a multi-tenant environment, a hosted environment, where I can say, okay, your tenant account is only going to get 1,500 IO. We need the ability to do that Correct. And right-size that. And so you can do that within Hyper-V and Windows Server, right?
Perfect. Yes, you can.
All right. And I think we have a few other little goodies in there, like enhanced session mode and a few other pieces like that we're going to be covering in this episode. So I think we should jump right into it. Clint, Crystal,
yep.
Do you think it's time to actually jump in and do some real work?
I think it's a perfect time. Let's get right to it.
Clint doesn't know what real work is.
All right, everyone. Welcome to our Hyper-V and System Center operational training. This is our sixth session that we're doing. It's our third one today. And today, I'm very lucky to be joined once again by my esteemed colleague, Clint Wyckoff. So my name is Dave Kula. I'm Microsoft MVP, industry MVP with Veeam and a few other companies out there. Clint is a Microsoft MVP as well. We're both cloud and data center management MVP specializing in Hyper-V. And Clint brings a wealth of knowledge on VMware as he is a VMware V expert. And he supported a large retail chain for a number of years running all on VMware. Right. Let's get this party started. So just once again, guys, as you're going through this, make sure you follow us on Twitter. Lots of good information out there. Mine's at Dave Kula. Clint's at Clint Wyckoff. All right. So we have some really cool stuff we're going to be going through. We're going to be covering a lot more of the operational side features of Hyper-V. And I think, Clint, we're probably going to get started off with a discussion around dynamic memory, which is always a little bit of an interesting conversation, especially coming from the VMware side. So kind of curious to see what your perspective on this is going to be. So why don't you just kind of quickly go over a bit of a review of, you know, dynamic memory as it was introduced by Microsoft, Clint, and if you could give us a comparison to what this looks like in the VMware side.
Well, the comparison from the VMware side is it doesn't exist. So that's pretty easy comparison. But no, so for you folks out there that might not be familiar, I know several of you have been managing Hyper-V for many years, and you're probably very well familiar with dynamic memory. But essentially, what this allows you to do is to kind of think back, right? Assigning memory to a virtual machine. You statically say, this virtual machine needs 8 gigabytes worth of memory. Therefore, the Hyper-V host allocates 8 gigabytes to a virtual machine. Dynamic memory allows that virtual machine to only take the amount of memory that's required inside of the guest operating system. So it can dynamically expand out, but it can also dynamically contract back in again so that the memory can be better used for other virtual machines on that host, right? So it's a way for it to dynamically expand out as well as expand back in again. So this really is an interesting topic, especially whenever you start thinking back on the, you know, the legacy page file that's inside the guest operating system, right? So one of the things that if you go out there in the individual machine, right, you can see that there's a page file, right? So if a virtual machine or even a physical machine has 4 gigs worth of memory allocated to it, it's going to have a 4 gig page file associated with it, right? So as you can see here, Dave's just illustrating the settings of a VM. So you can see here, you know, just by a checkbox, you can enable dynamic memory. You can also enable a floor or the minimum amount as well as the maximum amount. And then you can place a weight on that individual VM, right? So that allows you to basically say that this virtual machine is going to have a higher weight from a memory perspective than other VMs. So if I had, like, say, for instance, a SQL server, right, and he has a higher SLA, for instance, right, he would essentially be granted a heavier weight if he wanted to get that granular to allocate. Right there, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely, Clint. And the other thing is you'll notice how the dynamic memory checkbox right now is grayed out. The reason for that is we have two choices, and there's really two choices in configuring your virtual machine memory when it comes to Hyper-V. There's static RAM, which is what you see up here, and then there's dynamic memory down here. So if you choose static memory, you can adjust the memory on the fly. However, you can't enable dynamic memory on the fly. That feature set's still not quite available for us yet, in even in Hyper-V 2016. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to actually turn off one of our VMs that we're running here, Clint, just so that we can get into the settings here. And I'll just grab one of the ones that we don't need, like the Veeam backup server. Who needs that? Let's go ahead and take a look and see our configuration, 4 gigs of static RAM. So we'll go ahead and turn it off because that's a good idea to do to your Veeam server because Veeam is very resilient even in protecting itself. So we can go ahead and enable dynamic memory. So if you take a look at this machine, you notice how I have static RAM is set to 4 gigs right now, the minimum RAM set to 512, and the maximum RAM set higher. So this virtual machine can actually consume almost all of the memory that's viable and available on this particular machine. So now when I go ahead and start this virtual machine, one of the things that you're going to notice is the amount of memory that actually gets assigned. So do you notice how this 4096, the 4 gigs of memory, actually matches whatever this setting is right here, Clint? So it matches whatever the static RAM is. And now you'll notice how the dynamic memory is enabled. We can't disable it, can't change the static RAM. But we can adjust the minimum and maximum values. We can adjust the memory buffers and adjust the memory weights.
I also think it's worth noting there that, you know, that you can't, if you go back into the settings there really quickly.
Sure, and if you notice right here, see how that's already dropped down. So as soon as the integration services kick in, that's when the dynamic memory will kick in. It's not going to kick in before those integration services are available for you. So kind of a good note as well. All right, so you wanted me to go back to the memory settings here?
Yeah, so the minimum amount of memory there, so that's what the boot up memory is going to be for that individual virtual machine, right? So it's going to have at least 512 megabytes worth of memory, right, to make sure that it meets the system requirements there for the operating system.
Yeah, I think the startup RAM actually comes from the static setting, whatever is defaulted in the static setting. So if you leave that as 4 gigs inside of there, then it always starts with 4 gigs, but then it'll walk itself backwards. So you kind of have to be careful with those settings, because if you leave them all set really high for static RAM in there and you go to turn them all on, you can actually run yourself out of memory in a startup condition. I'm a big static
fan. I think they actually changed the user interface, because I was looking at an example here where it actually lists at the top there startup RAM.
Oh, are you Are you using the full RTM version? Because I'm still on Technical Preview 5.
This is a little older, I think.
Server 2012 R2 says startup RAM explicitly. I think 2016 is going back to the old language.
Yeah.
RAM. Yeah.
Like, if you're on a 2012 server, this, I think, says startup RAM right here.
Yeah, that's what I was just looking at.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think Carl's probably right, because he's probably looking at his console right now in 2012 R2. All right. Okay. So let me flip back to our other screen here. There we go. All right. So now...
Some of the capabilities there, like smart paging, ballooning, those obviously require the integration services to be present, but you should definitely have integration services in all your virtual machines.
Yeah, for sure. And so when we take a look at the smart paging functionality, this really comes into play when you start running that machine out of memory, right, Clint? All right, get some different pooling settings inside of here. Now there's also something else to really be aware of, guys. Clint, what do you typically recommend, or what's the general recommendation that you've seen for host reserves? Because I've seen people take, hypervisors like what I've got, like this machine. So let me just show you what I've actually got here. So this particular server that we've got has 192 gigs of RAM on it, right? And out of the 192 gigs of RAM, is it possible, Clint, to actually run yourself out of memory for the host? Because the host is still going to require a certain portion of memory to actually operate, to function properly, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you can even overcommit from a memory perspective. That's when performance really goes down the tube. So one of the things that I like to do whenever I was running, though, this is a little bit different because I was running a VMware shop, but I think the same principles apply from a Hyper-V perspective, too. So in our tech dev environment, we used to, this was several years ago, so our blade, they were IBM blades, they only had 48 gigs worth of memory per blade, and we would try to run them anywhere between 90 to 95% memory utilized. Just like everybody else, CPU is never the bottleneck, it's always memory. So it was tech dev environment, we were okay running that hot, 90 to 95%. And that was around, 50-ish virtual machines from a test dev perspective, and that was good. Performance was okay. Now, in our production environment, we never went above 75% on a host. If a host started to get close to 75%, we would, DRS would kick in, and it would start to migrate things around the environment via just traditional vMotion, or we would look to add additional hosts to the infrastructure.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing that you want to be careful of is you want to make sure that you reserve enough memory on the system, because by default, this is really bad, but Hyper-V is stupid, and I can't believe I'm saying that, but it's stupid in the fact that it'll let you consume all of the running RAM on the individual given machine. So, for example, on this particular server that we're looking at, if this thing has 192 gigs of RAM, and I open up Task Manager, I show you this. This thing's creeping up as all the VMs are starting, and then flatlines out at, 191 gigs of RAM. Well, it's not leaving very much for my host partition, my parent partition, to do anything. And so all of a sudden, I start to have, right-click and console issues and all of this. Right. So normally, my normal buffer that I'll have when, I build these things out is I want anywhere between 5 to 10% left for the actual host itself. It all really depends on the size of the host, because in all honesty, if I have a box with 512 gigs of RAM, Clint, I'm not going to go allocate 50 gigs of RAM for the host itself. So this number will walk backwards the bigger the actual host is itself. Normally I like to leave kind of a minimum of around 8 gigs of RAM to actually run my host processes, because a lot of people are running host level antivirus. So you have to make sure that there's enough memory available for a host level AV. Maybe you're running some System Center components. Maybe you have some SCCM agents on there. Anything that you add on top of this host, this is no different than any other running server. You have to make sure that you leave enough room in your host reserve to run all of this. So, you know, your mileage is going to vary for what you're going to set in your environment, but make sure that you're taking and configuring your host reserves. I'm actually going to have Clint look up the registry keys for this so that we can show you this, but you can actually define registry keys where you can implement host reserves to prevent yourself from this scenario where you completely run yourself out of memory. It's a bad situation to be in, because the other thing that you want to make sure of is that if you're in a clustered environment, let's say you've got a 3-node or more cluster, you've got to make sure that you leave enough room on each of these nodes so that if one goes down, I can fail over the resources to the remaining node. So you don't want to completely pin these things 100% of the time. Just all depends on the density and the number of hosts that you have, right? So it's just this little thing that you just don't want to forget about. All right. Okay, so the next one is virtual fiber channel. And I have to be perfectly honest, Clint, I left this slide in there just because it is a feature in Hyper-V. It does show up inside the UI, and everybody always asks me what it's used for. So if I take and I come back to our host server here, inside of our host server, there's an option inside of Hyper-V called the Virtual SAN Manager. So that's this little guy right here. Now, Clint, have you ever seen anybody in production actually using the virtual fiber channel pass-through? We actually had an interesting discussion on our Hyper-V distribution list from Microsoft. Like, how many people actually use this?
And I can't say I've actually ever seen anybody.
Yeah. So for you folks that are on VMware out there, this is basically the equivalent in Microsoft of where you would take and you'd configure your raw device mappings from your fiber channel ones. So we could actually take that SAN and we could pass through a connection to the fiber channel SAN directly via this raw device mapping. Now remember, you lose support for stuff like VSS and some of these pieces, and you might have to start relying on hardware-based VSS snapshots if you want to have, you know, eloquent ways of backing this up. And it gets pretty ugly pretty fast. So we talked about this in some of the previous sessions, but that's what the virtual fiber channel is. It is really, truly an emulated fiber channel port that you can take and that you can use. And so basically how it'll work is no differently than connecting to a traditional fiber channel SAN. You're going to have an HBA typically in your physical server, and that HBA that's going to be inside of your physical server is going to take and is going to connect into your SAN. So it's going to look something like this, right? So you'll have an HBA in each of these, and basically what happens here is you create this virtual HBA or virtual fiber channel adapter. He's going to have its own unique worldwide name for identification. And that's basically how the SANs actually work for fiber channel. Okay, so it is possible. It's used. MPIO support is there for it. I don't believe there's any specific DSMs that you actually download. So normally when you take and you configure MPIO or iSCSI and stuff like that, you can have DSMs. And gosh, I always forget what the acronym for it is. I know what they are. They're the MPIO, manufacturer MPIO drivers. Clint will look that up for me and we'll get the actual acronym because I forget, it's been a long day. But normally you actually have to have separate drivers. So for example, I'm doing a project right now with one of our customers, and they've actually been on a few of the phone calls with us so far, a few of the sessions that we've done. And they're connecting this SAN down here, this fiber channel SAN that we're using to connect into for their Hyper-V hosts is an IBM SAN. And so the IBM SAN actually has specific DSMs that you have to load in order to take and have have MPIO or multipathing working properly. Because if I don't load these DSMs, these MPIO and DSM drivers on my hosts, what ends up happening is I might present a LUN. So let's say I present a LUN to this particular host, and this is supposed to be MUN 5 or something like that, it actually shows up times however many paths I have. So if I have two paths, I actually see the disk duplicating in there times 2, times 4, and you don't want that. And so if you ever see that in Disk Manager, multiple disks showing up, it means your multipathing isn't actually working properly. You should only ever see one logical representation of this in Disk Manager. And with that, these DSMs are like any other driver. They need to be watched, updated, firmware, all of those pieces. So whenever you directly attach these Hyper-V hosts to Fibre Channel Array, make sure that you're taking and you're getting the latest supported versions from their manufacturer. Now, that being said, this guy right here, your virtual fiber channel adapter, he's going to have to just basically use the native Microsoft MPIO, because I don't know that there are, MPIO. I don't know that there's native drivers inside. Like I said, it's not something that I've really seen in the field, and we've actually had some really good discussions out there in the field around people using it. Just know that it is possible for you guys to use if you want to. Live migration, all these pieces fully work under the covers as well. All right, so this is actually a really fun one for us, Clint. This one here is... this one here is the storage quality of service. So did you want to just take a quick second to talk a little bit about the history of storage quality of service? Because we have some of the customers on here that are on 2012 and some that are going to be going directly to 2016. What do we have today? So in 2012 R2, does Microsoft even have storage quality of service? Is it even possible to use storage quality of service?
They do, and it's only on an individual virtual hard disk level, not even an entire virtual machine level, right? So you can configure quality of service in 2012 R2 only on individual VHDX level, right? What's new within Windows Server 2016 is it can be policy driven, so you can have either, you're putting me on the spot, what the hell are two different, there's two different policies that putting me on the spot. Stand by just one second.
I'll go get him. It's okay. But as you can
essentially you can set two different policies, right? So there can be a policy for the quality of service across multiple virtual machines that say this group of virtual machines get a minimum of 500 IOPS and a maximum of 1,500, single instance and multi-instance, that's what it is. Single instance quality of service says a group of virtual machines gets a minimum of 500 IOPS in a maximum of 1,500 IOPS, right?
Yep. And so that's with the new settings inside Server 2016, right? And so where do we actually configure those settings from a storage quality service? Like, where do we define and how do we define those policies?
Yeah, within the failover cluster or the scale-out file server itself, wherever your virtual machine hard disks are residing, it's policy-driven. So you need to have that central management pane being either Failover Cluster Manager or the scale-out file server itself to
minimize this guy.
Minimize you. But the nice thing about the multi-instance policy there, Dave, is it guarantees each virtual machine. In that same example where I said 500, 1,500 minimum, maximum, each virtual machine and every virtual hard disk would get 500, 1,500 IOPS, for instance.
Yeah.
Whereas with the single instance, it is cumulative across all the virtual machines in that policy.
For sure. And I think you can have, so you can see right here, guys, I've got my storage quality of service resource. So this guy here is actually monitoring inside of this cluster. And so you can drive and define these policies via PowerShell, and you can have kind of different lanes of IO that you can drive. Like Clint said, you can do it on an individual VM basis. You can do it on a policy basis, min, max. Pretty much anything that you can think of having to configure from a storage quality of service capability is all possible now when you take a look at Windows Server 2016. So the capabilities have really been broadened. And if you are still running on 2012 R2 and you're on a platform that is using native Hyper-V, then you can take and you can configure it on a per VHDX basis. And depending on the size of your environment, you know, that may be fine, Clint, because, you know, you can make those settings via PowerShell as well. So let's say you're only managing 30 or 40 VMs. Well, in theory, you could actually get away with running some fairly effective storage cross policies on there. The problem is they're not dynamic and you're probably wasting a lot of the resources that you have. And that's why they really went to that policy driven engine. That's my understanding anyways. So, and they would need to have competitive features. So I can kind of dial it up and down. Okay. So, well, let's just go back to the storage quality of service. Like where would this really be coming in handy, Clint? Is from my perspective is if you're taking and you're doing IO and load testing, I think we've all been hit by a situation where we've had a runaway VM. Like, did you ever see that when you were managing your VMware farms and this really doesn't matter what platform you're on, a runaway VM is a runaway VM. And the definition of that is something that's consuming all of the IO in your SAN. Mm-hmm. And so
we used to have the noisy neighbor.
Noisy neighbor, that's what it is, yeah.
Yeah, we used to have, our security team used to run an application called LogRhythm, mm-hmm. and it goes out and like scans log files. And they were famous for running log scans in the middle of the day. So anytime we saw the performance of our virtualized environment, it was all VMware, but it's still, all this stuff applies. We would immediately call the security, hey, you running any scans? What's going on? You know, kind of thing. Because, yeah, you would instantly see the IO on the storage array just spike. And that would take down the performance because they're all on the same, you know, whether it be VMFS data store or a CSV, right? Any spike in I/O because it's all sharing the underlying storage architecture, whether that be the same spinning disk, the same controller, whatever, right? You would instantly see performance tank. So the nice thing about the storage quads here is that you can guarantee at least I/O, right? To individual VMs. So this doesn't fix any type of latency issues, right? So latency is a completely other problem. And that's generally where you see, you know, if I have a storage array performance, CPU performance of the controller spike, right, you'll see latency go through the roof, whereas I/O might not necessarily. So depending on what's going on in the environment, there's a couple of different things that can affect either one of those. The first being, you know, from an I/O perspective, if I've got a virtual machine, that exact example that I just gave where, you know, they're doing scans in the middle of the day, so I/O across the entire data store spike, that's an I/O, you know, kind of noisy neighbor issue. But maybe I have separate problem where it still affects performance and it's still related to storage, but not necessarily I/O, is maybe I had a customer one time who had an EMC, I think it was a Clarion. They had post-process deduplication running in the middle of the day, right? So that would cause the CPU utilization on the their Clarion to spike, cause performance and latency to, you know, shoot through the roof. But here we're talking about I/O, and the nice thing about the quality of service that you can define in a per VM level is you can kind of protect yourself because it'll steal I/O away from the virtual machine spiking to guarantee the most important VMs and virtual hard disks on those Hyper-V nodes, the performance that they need.
Yeah, like absolutely. And, you know, I had a situation where we had some active file level scans running inside of our virtual farm, Clint. And basically what it was doing is it was taking 300 VMs. And this is the other funny thing, right, that I often see is that customers will go out and they'll spend all of their money on this. They'll take and they'll spend a good chunk of their budget on this little guy called a SAN, right? And so this SAN, basically, when it's built, provisioned, whatever you want to call it, has X number of IOPS, right, that it can actually drive. And so when the customer starts off, they start off with, let's say they've got three hosts that are actually connecting into the SAN. Oh, and then they ran that for 6 months and everything ran just fine. Then all of a sudden the company grew and they decided that they were going to add three more hosts inside of here. Well, what did they not upgrade? they didn't upgrade the underlying storage underneath. And they just kept putting more and more pressure on it. And this number of hosts just kept going up and up and up. I'm working with one customer right now that runs a single VMware farm in Fabric. That IBM SAN that I was telling you about, Clint, that's driving, like, the number of hosts that's driving right now is 20 plus hosts right now off of that single SAN. And so that can potentially be an awful lot of I/O that's being driven inside of there. And so what you find is that over time, performance just starts to go down and things start to get slow and time of day issues and all of these problems that you run into, right? And so the ability to right size and, you know, dial it up or, you know, dial it down as you need it is huge inside of every environment. And one of the kind of closing point on storage quality of service is Microsoft's vision, cloud first, cloud everything vision, where they want to take and run all of these different environments and kind of shared ecosystem, shared infrastructure. That's kind of the big driver to say, okay, well, you know, you purchased a VM and it's an A2 VM and I'm going to give you, you know, 1,000 IO with that, or you purchased an A1 VM, I'm going to take and I'm going to give you 500 IO with this. And so being able to actually dial that in inside of your organization is important too, because when you build your infrastructure, you really have to think about how much IO your workloads are going to be needed. All right. So Clint and I do quite a bit of work with performance around Hyper-V as well. And receive-side scaling is a really interesting one. And I find that, you know, not all manufacturers actually take advantage of using receive-side scaling and even virtual receive-side scaling so that you can actually pass near line rate speeds through and into your virtual machines without having, you know, underlying performance reductions. And where you're going to really see this being big benefits for organizations, Clint, is customers are starting to build their data centers, and I'm already starting to see this. They're already starting to build with 40 and 100 gig backplanes. And so, you know, how much data that you can aggregate, data you can pump through there is huge. So if you start to have bottlenecks where you're using a single CPU core to do things, that's really not a good solution. And so with the receive side scaling, your incoming packets and how they're actually driven without receive side scaling is they're actually going to come through individual cores, right? And so with receive side scaling, you can actually spread that out across your CPU cores and your virtual procs. So it's important to actually get this set up and configured properly. Now, everyone, you got to take this with a grain of salt, though, right? Because what is the actual legitimate performance delta with or without for most customers? I would honestly have to say, Clint, that most customers are never really going to push their infrastructure to its maximum where they're, you know, pushing ultimate bottlenecks, unless you're a hoster or you have something like ultra high density like VDI or something like that. So a lot of customers, this doesn't even really apply to. It doesn't make that much difference. It's like using jumbo frames, for example, when we used to do iSCSI deployments. Okay, we would see a 10% performance difference on, you know, CPU utilization on the host. Okay, but now I got to go configure all my switches. What if I'm not a good network guy? Can I still make my iSCSI work without jumbo frames? Yeah. Is it still fast? Yeah. Is it as fast as it could be? No, not necessarily. So not everything needs to be tweaked to the maximum to use it. Sometimes the instant on, turn it on and just have it work is kind of good enough as well. What are your thoughts around that?
No, I mean, I think that's a great example. I was just on a call last week with a large provider of services down in Australia where they were kind of not complaining but expressing some frustrations they were having in their Hyper-V environment because they had some really high performance RDMA network interface cards with their storage array, and it was all SSD, and they were, you know, complaining about backup performance, right? Well, is it really a problem, or is it just kind of something that would be nice to have because it can, you know, it can perform at that highest level? So just as you mentioned, right, you have this infrastructure, is it really required from an application perspective? Yeah, those guys had 3 terabytes worth of memory and 72 cores in their Hyper-V host. So they had some pretty beefy environment. They need it for the services that they provide. Wow, yeah. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's something that I go back and forth with all the time, because as IT guys, we like to think and talk speeds and feeds, and my environment can go X, Y, and Z fast. But what necessary value is that really providing to the environment? Is it worth the additional management? Is it worth the additional overhead? Is it worth the additional time to put in there to troubleshoot, to try to figure out specifically, you know, where you could squeeze an extra few, you know, megaseconds of throughput? Or is it kind of good enough for the apps and services that you're servicing? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm along the same mindset. But so for receive side scaling, and you know, our customers don't understand this, basically without it, you're gonna be limited and bound to a single virtual proc, and that virtual NIC is gonna be bound to that virtual proc. So you could imagine me having a 40 gig set of connectivity that I've got piping in, and I'm trying to actually push through 10 or 20 gigs of data. Well, now I'm trying to push through 10 or 20 gigs of data through a single virtual CPU core. You're going to have a bottleneck there. And believe it or not, guys, there's actually quite a few applications. I forget what the terminology is for this, Clint, but it's like Core Zero or something like that. Oh, man, we went through that call last week with that customer, and I can't remember exactly what they called it, but it was a good definition of it. But basically
CPU,
what it is,
CPU Zero.
CPU Zero, that's what it is, sorry. And so that's what it is. It's like your first core inside of your either physical or virtual processor stack. And all of this resourcing power is left unused, right? And so what features like this are designed to do is unlock the capabilities and potential for these, you know, bigger, larger environments that are really maxing things out, because now we can actually go spread across and we can use all of those cores, right? And then we can spread that across, you know, all of the different nodes and incoming packets, and you know, it's just, it really takes and speeds things up, right? A couple of the other options that are available, and this started with Server 2012 R2, is the ability to do live cloning of a virtual machine. And so this was really handy if you had to take and, you know, clone a VM from a kind of a point in time image. So this is pretty neat that you can do this, and you can actually export from existing checkpoints, and you can build clones from existing checkpoints now. And those features and functionality are still available in 2016 as well. Now, I can't remember, Clint, do you actually need VMM to do the clone?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
I can't remember either. I'll have to double check to see for you guys. We'll double check to make sure. Now, I see that one of the things that that Clint has pasted into your chat window is the memory reserve setting, okay? So what I want you guys to do is, after the session's done, we don't really save the chat sessions as part of the recordings. So what you need to do is just copy and paste that other, and what that was the host reserve to set the minimum amount of memory on your Hyper-V hosts to make sure that you don't have them run away on you. Once again, another one of our kind of comparisons for our VMware guys that are out there. And so these settings, so this is a 2012 R2 slide. Clint, what's the maximum number of what's our RAM limitation that we have now per host? So in 2016, so if I had to draw another line down here for 2016, 2016 is absolutely blowing all of these numbers out of the water, guys. So I think virtual CPUs now per VM is in the hundreds now, isn't it? Isn't it like 256 or something? I can't remember.
I saw an email a while back, but it wasn't even like finalized. I'm pretty sure that the memory, wasn't it like 64 terabytes or 32 terabytes worth of memory or something like that? That was per virtual machine.
I think this is at least 20 plus now for 2016.
Yeah.
All of these settings are all still inside of there, but the actual size and scalability, because what they're doing is we're moving back to a world of super servers, right? So less servers, but everything's going to be a super server. And I'll make the offer to anyone on the call again. If any of you feel like you've got budget to go buy a server with 3 terabytes plus of RAM, Clint and I will fly on site and we will help you configure that, as long as we get to take some Twitter selfies with that server for social media. Yeah, I don't even want to know. How much was it?
24 terabytes per physical host.
Ooh.
16 terabytes per virtual machine. You can have up to 512 logical processors in a host and 240 virtual processors per virtual machine.
And this was on the host, and it was 240 for the guest, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Could you imagine your pull down for CPUs? Seeing that many inside of there? That is crazy. Absolutely crazy, the new specs. Like,
it's all right here.
This stuff gets so big, almost unfathomable.
How big my muscles kind of thing, you know, who has the biggest VM? Would you ever virtualize an application that needs 24 terabytes worth of memory? I mean, you're better off just giving its own dedicated piece of hardware.
Like how long would virtual backups take in there? Like, I don't even know the scale and the compute of like, those are some pretty specific use case things that you would have, right? So.
Right.
The only thing that I could think is that you'd get into some some DND type activities, you know, national defense type stuff where you're doing massive crunching. It's just unbelievable. All right. We'll come back to this one. The VMM section, I'm just going to adjust some of these slides because we're going to do a specific session on Virtual Machine Manager coming up very shortly here. Linux support on Hyper-V, this has constantly been expanding, and what I can tell you right now is that Microsoft has a commitment to having an open hypervisor framework that will actively support Linux distributions, and they're broadening support for this all the time. And the actual integration services for Hyper-V are actually coming embedded in a lot of the distros now. So you actually need to take advantage of the synthetic NICs and some of the other pieces that we've talked about in the previous sessions. We need to make sure that we have our integration services installed inside of that virtual machine, right, Clint? And these are coming pre-installed inside of those Linux distributions, a lot of them. So this is just a small subset. And remember, this is just for server 2012 R2. The list gets bigger for server 2016. All right, so you can see that we can take and we can have decent support for vCPUs, live backups, and your integration services support, dynamic memory support, virtual SCSI support. So basically all those same types of feature sets are going to be, for the most part, supported for you. Can you guys still hear me okay?
Yeah, you're there. I can hear you.
Okay,
good.
Perfect. I just had a little bit of feedback there. So the VMM stuff, once again, I'm going to readjust these slides, so don't worry about the VMM pieces, guys, because Clint and I are actually going to go through a live build of standing up the Virtual Machine Manager 2016 to manage all this stuff. I just didn't have a chance to juggle all the slides between all the sessions. Okay, so the Gen 2 virtual machines, I think we had talked about this in the earlier sessions, didn't we? I don't think we actually had a slide for it when we went through and talked about it. So if you want to do stuff like having UEFI support for your virtual machines and supporting secure boot, this is going to be one that's going to start to be really, really important for our healthcare customers that are out there. So I noticed that we have on the call Michael, and so Michael Dutcher. And so he works for a healthcare organization in Washington. And these were big pieces for him, was UEFI support and for the actual host server itself, as well as the VMs, and making sure that all of your data at rest was protected. And so, you know, looking at support as well inside of here for self-encrypting drives and BitLocker and all of those other pieces to make sure that somebody can't just walk into your data center. Remember in the previous session that we did, guys, if you can control C, control V, what can you do with Hyper-V, Clint?
Manage it.
And steal it.
Steal it.
Control C, Control V, you can steal Hyper-V. So you need to make sure you protect that data at rest, and that's what a lot of these pieces do. One of the things that we're going to be talking at length about in some of the later sessions is some brand new capabilities that are coming with Windows Server 2016 that is going to extend capabilities into our Gen 1 and Gen 2 VMs, and that is a virtual TPM module. So this is going to be a big reason for, you know, guys like yourself, Michael, to start looking at Windows Server 2016. That virtual TPM chip, that virtual TPM module that can be passed through from our host server, where we would used to just take and encrypt the data at rest, the actual VMs and the hard drives. Now we can encrypt the VMs themselves. We can run BitLocker inside of the VMs. So our BitLocker here can actually run inside. So you can go ahead and you can steal whatever you want. Doesn't matter because that VM is rendered essentially useless because of the virtual TPM chip that has been added. This is something that is unique to Microsoft. The other players on the market have not yet caught up to add this set of capabilities. And this is huge for the Microsoft cloud, especially when it comes to securing those workloads, because now you could in essence effectively run some of those workloads in a hybrid configuration where we have them running on-prem or in Azure and we're still protected in a similar fashion. This functionality is going to be getting extended out to Microsoft Azure at some point in time. Right now on-prem didn't take and have that on-prem, so that is kind of a cool new add-on for our Gen 2 boxes. The VMM stuff I'll come back to. Enhanced session mode, we had talked about this in the previous session. You have to go through and you have to enable this on your virtual machines. Enables remote desktop over the VM bus, smart card redirection, copy and paste, and audio over VM Connect as well. So we've got a few enhanced capabilities inside of here. How are we doing? We've got about 15 minutes left or so, Clint. Did you want to talk about this one, the automatic virtual machine activation, and why this is important for us?
So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Am I muted now?
Yeah, we got you.
So the NVMA automatically go ahead and handles all the licensing, right? So essentially what that does is you don't have to worry about managing the licensing of the guest virtual machines on the Hyper-V host, depending on which version you run, depends on how many operating system environments or OSCs you can run free of charge. So Standard Edition gives you two OSCs, our operating system environments, and then the Data Center Edition allows you to run as many instances as you want, and the NVMA handles the automatic license registration across all those virtual machines.
Perfect.
I feel like you're testing me. Like, okay, what's NVMA?
You wrote a book about it, so I figured you'd be good on it.
Right.
This topic is number seven.
So you think this one should have been way earlier, Carl? Licensing.
No, we're in six, right?
Yeah, we're in session six.
And you've just gone over several topics that your agenda, Dave, said you're going to do in seven.
Did I? Could quite possibly be. We could have extended over. That's all right. We'll just adjust. It just gives more time for more demos and lots of other things afterwards. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're...
Because the
That
Linux...
might have happened.
Yeah. Okay. Never mind. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. You're going to talk about Linux. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have time. We have time. We can dive into anything you want here, Carl.
Have you ever had one of the Linux OSs that have had the built-in integration services, but then a newer one comes out? Have you ever attempted to scrape the services off and install the new one?
Not personally, no. I'm guessing it's not very pretty.
Oh, I mean, well, I'm not super familiar with Linux, but it's apparently a series of, you know, the only thing that concerns me is the couple of minutes after you've scraped it off, is it going to blow up your Linux or, you know, you're fine because you're on the console and whatnot.
Yeah, the integrated services that you have aren't going to take and aren't going to, like, peel back core functionality for you. Unless when you're taking and you're updating that, the integrated services go away, because what you would lose the capability of having is the synthetic network adapters, right? So if you're running a Generation 2 virtual machine, yeah, I suppose there would be a potential hiccup inside of there. So the only thing I could say is test. Depends on the distro, depends on what's going on. The big thing that I've seen from Microsoft is that you used to be 100% on your own with this stuff, Carl. Like, you want to run Linux on Hyper-V? Sure. it'll mount. Yeah. It'll boot. You go for it. But now Linux is actually fully supported by the platform team. So, like, if you ever got yourself into a situation where something really bad happened, you can actually phone Microsoft platform support for those running Linux instances. It is something that Microsoft's worked really hard to try to improve. When I first became a Hyper-V MVP, Carl, this was about 5-6 years ago, we were just starting the discussions back then about running Linux and Hyper-V and how much it sucked, and this is why everybody used VMware and blah, 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 and there was no support. And then I'll tell you when the big transition happened for Microsoft.
Oh.
It was really simple. It was when Satya Nadella took over, and we had the kumbaya, we need to be friends with everybody model at Microsoft. That is when this stuff really started to change. And that started about like 2-3 years ago or whenever he took over. And so...
Well, the reason I ask is because of backups and whatnot. In the past, you know, because we used DPM, it was that thing where it would pause the VM and back it up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the integration services, you can have... online, in other words, I don't know if it's VSS or what the hell it uses with the Linux machine, but while the Linux machine is running, you can just do a backup, but it has to have a high enough version of the integration services.
Of course. Right.
So, you know, that online backup is something I really want. So,
you know, Linux uses what's called pre-freeze and post-thaw scripts. To put anything in quiescence, if you require any level of, you know, application, for instance, you have like a DB2 database running in a Linux virtual machine, and you require it to be application consistent, and there is no VSS in the Linux world, they use what is called pre-freeze and post-thaw scripts to put those in a quiescent state. And typically, like, your DBA would be responsible for creating those scripts and giving them to you, being either the virtualization admin or the backup admin. At least that's what I've seen.
Yeah, and if that's something that's of more interest for you as well, Carl, what we can look at doing is, as we have some of these areas that we're covering, if there's stuff that you really want to drill into specifically, we could actually almost make a Linux session all on its own, right? Just going through and taking a look at some of this stuff. So, you know, the agenda that we have is kind of a loose framework of, you know, what I put together from an operational standpoint. And if there's stuff that we want to dig in a bit more, yeah, we can definitely do that for sure. I'm not a big Linux guy, so it's a tough one for me, because short of copying and pasting commands, my knowledge is a little limited, right? So I can spin up some appliances and, you know, muck my way through and change some IP addresses, but I'm by no means an expert in Linux. So
that's the threshold of my knowledge too.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'm actually looking at my agenda. So Clint, we actually kind of tagged session 6 and 7 topics here for the most part. That's okay. Those probably should have been merged into one session anyways. So the next one that we're going to have, guys, the next session that we're going to do is going to be covering some more live migration components, but a little bit more at a technical level, looking at some of the architecture behind how you want to build some of those live migration networks properly. And then we're going to start getting into, at that point in time, I was going to I was going to change it up a bit at that point in time because we're kind of through some of the core sets of functionality that are provided by Failover Cluster Manager and Hyper-V Manager and just the native Hyper-V UI. I think after we get through that live migration session, we'll probably start digging into the installation of Virtual Machine Manager and the extended capabilities that Virtual Machine Manager is going to provide. And that'll probably be at least a couple sessions in itself. So the agenda is going to be a little fluid. We will cover most of the topics that I've got laid out. It's just we'll adjust depending on what the flow kind of feels like here. So guys, I think we're probably good for this session here, unless anybody else has any questions. Does anybody have any other questions? We've got the chat session open here. Clint and I are available for another 5 minutes. So if you guys have questions or you want to chat with us, this is your time and kind of framework. I know Michael Dutcher, I think you had a question for me this morning. Sorry, I didn't get around to it. I'm not sure if it's applicable for the session or not, but we're here, so.
Can I ask about the virtual RSS?
Yeah, for sure. Go ahead.
Is the only thing you have to do, I mean, it's got to be on the host, of course, but you just go into the guest, in the guest's NIC, and there's the turn it on, and boom, you're done?
Yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah, you got to make sure that it's all supported. It's not quite that simple. NIC drivers and firmwares, and there's stuff behind the scenes that come in to actually bring those things to work properly.
There's a good article right here for you.
But there's some commands, I don't know if they're PowerShell commands, that'll tell you if it's supported.
Yeah.
Just type it in and it says, yeah, this will work.
Yeah, Mike, you're on the same platform as Carl's on right now. So Michael Dutcher from the hospital that I was talking about that's on the call here, Carl, he's actually on the same GridStore platform that you are. And I think they actually set up. Did you end up setting up all of those features, Mike? I don't know if he's on or not. See, he's unmuted. But he went through and enabled a whole bunch of that. What I may do is I may connect you two guys. Oh.
I am, but you can't hear me. What was the question? Are you using the VRSS?
Yeah, so enabling all the extended features on the GridStore appliances, because Carl's got basically the same configurations that you have, little different chassis and stuff, but same general configs. Mike went through and tweaked all of that stuff. He got most of those pieces working, so. Maybe an offline discussion. So maybe what I'll do is, Carl, Mike, if it's okay with you, I might connect you and Carl together, just two guys, and just chat independently with one another. So
he said, yeah, no problem.
Okay. Sounds good. Awesome. So guys, I'm going to be sending out a few more emails tonight. The next set of sessions are going to be coming tomorrow. So I'll if you want to stay on the call with me here, Mike, I'll pull up. I haven't had a chance to read your full email yet. He's just chatting in there. So what we can do is, if you want to stay on the call with me, or I can call you on your cell phone or something. It's not a problem. I can call you after here. So I'll be sending out a quick note to everybody. The next three sessions will actually be coming up tomorrow. I know that these are rapid pace and it's tough to maybe catch all of these in a given day, guys. I do appreciate that. But I have one of my customers that is so important that we actually get their guys trained up operationally. So I have to get these sessions done by probably middle of next week. So they're going to be coming in rapid fire format here. You'll probably be seeing at least two to three a day until we get through most of these. If you miss one or you're busy, it's not a problem. We're recording them all. Everything's up in that OneDrive link for you. So you guys will be good to go. So I hope you can join as many as you can. Clint, thank you very much. I hope you're able to join our sessions tomorrow. I know that
tomorrow,
you're a very busy guy.
Tomorrow, I will not be available. Yeah, tomorrow I will not be.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, we definitely appreciate your time today. Your input is amazing as always. And guys, thank you very much for tuning in to this third session that we've done today.
Cheers, everyone.
Thanks. Hey, Dave, can you hear me?